Hey everyone, it's Guy Evans here, welcoming you to another edition of Beyond Nitro. And this month, we're going to examine a tale of two finishes, WrestleMania 40 versus Starrcade 97. Aside from the obvious factors at play, why exactly did one of these events triumph, whereas the other, according to most objective observers, ultimately fell short? Today I'm going to discuss three factors which kind of separate these two events. The subtleties of the storytelling, the use of nostalgia, and finally a certain, shall we say, je ne sais quoi, which provided an emotional backdrop for the entire WrestleMania 40 event. So with no further ado, let's get into it. It's episode 4 of Beyond Nitro, A Tale of Two Finishes. In a relatively viral post made in the aftermath of WrestleMania 40, one social media user described an electric post-show scene in Philadelphia. Starrcade 97, wrote the commenter in question, attaching a video of Cody Rhodes celebrating in the ring, but booked to perfection. Subsequently, a variety of other users chimed in with similar observations, as if to underscore the fact, although it may not be obvious at first, that the two landmark events, WrestleMania 40 and Starrcade 97, are in fact relatively apt for comparison. For example, each event represented the culmination of a dramatic, long-term, and innovative storyline. Furthermore, each holds the distinction of being the most lucrative event in their respective company histories. With respect to Starrcade 97, for instance, and putting to the side, albeit momentarily, its dubious and controversial legacy, the show generated an estimated $18 million in pay-per-view revenue, the equivalent of $35 million, adjusted for inflation, today. At the time, the mainstream press could hardly believe their eyes upon examination of the financial numbers. World Championship Wrestling continues to astound and surprise the pay-per-view industry, gushed Multichannel News in a January 11, 1998 article. Operators said buy rates for the organization's December 28th Starrcade pay-per-view event nearly doubled those for the highest WCW event to date, making it one of the highest performing wrestling events ever. In fact, continued Multichannel News in the article, the show, which earned a preliminary 1.9% buy rate, was the third biggest pay-per-view event of 1997, besting November's Evander Holyfield-Michael Moore heavyweight championship fight. Similarly, in terms of its sheer financial impact, WrestleMania 40 could only be described as an overwhelming success. The highest grossing event in WWE history, summarized Dwayne The Rock Johnson on social media. Highest selling WrestleMania in WWE history. Most TV viewed WrestleMania in WWE history. Most social media viewed WrestleMania in WWE history. Most single day WWE YouTube views ever, close quote. However, as a large segment of wrestling fans will surely point to, the critical reception surrounding each event could hardly have been more different. While observers mostly lauded the WrestleMania 40 finish, with various accounts purporting its presentation as something resembling a cinematic ending, Starrcade 97 offers, in retrospective comparison, a rather confusing, convoluted, and ultimately ineffective conclusion to a red-hot storyline. Whereas WrestleMania 40, some recency bias granted, received near-universal critical acclaim, Starrcade 97 received a near-commensurate amount of non-acclaim, a vehemently negative response which has only intensified over time. Quite obviously, the discrepancy between Starrcade's financial and critical success can largely be attributed to its failure in delivering a, quote, clean victory for Sting in the main event versus Hogan, the details of which, at this point, have been painfully well established. While at different times there may have been various uplifting moments in which WCW presented an important babyface triumph, Goldberg's title win in July 1998, for example, or Lex Luger's own dethroning of Hogan in August of 97, fans have endlessly rued the missed opportunity of Starrcade. People invested a lot of time in watching our shows, says David Penza, the former WCW ring announcer, in a section of his new book, Sitting Ringside Volume 1. They purchased tickets to see us live, bought our merchandise, and even followed the gossip on the WCW hotline, or the internet, which was really in its infancy at that time. At some point, you need to pay off all of that support. To that end, while some 26 years later, WWE initially booked Cody Rhodes to lose at WrestleMania 39, fans ultimately received their desired payoff in the end, and, according to many longtime industry veterans, Rhodes' setback only served to make his eventual victory that much more significant. But the purpose of this month's edition of Beyond Nitro is not to relitigate the familiar issues with the Starrcade 97 finish, nor to discuss the obvious differences between its presentation and that of WrestleMania 40. These differences are, at this point certainly, relatively self-evident and therefore hardly in need of analysis. For example, although in kayfabe terms, Rhodes secured his pinfall after a host of outside interference and other such shenanigans, his win was ultimately presented as decisive over Roman Reigns, totally dissimilar, in other words, from the fiasco of Sting versus Hogan. Therefore, it's the focus of this month's episode to examine three of the more nuanced factors at play, relative to how WrestleMania 40 succeeded, whereas Starrcade 97 ultimately fell short. Factor 1. Storytelling subtleties. Famously, or perhaps infamously, the long-awaited Sting-Hogan clash promised a conclusion to a storyline of unprecedented length, drama, and intrigue. It was billed as the match of the century, read a passage in the Nitro book, an apparently perfect culmination of almost 18 months of storytelling. On December 28, 1997, in front of a sold-out MCI Center in Washington, D.C., Hollywood Hogan would finally, surely, receive his comeuppance against the most loyal of WCW soldiers, the franchise, Sting. "We built that story perfectly," reminisced Eric Bischoff in the book. "It was totally incomprehensible to the Kevin Sullivans of the world, to the Dusty Rhodes of the world, and other people who were involved at various times in the creative process. They would never have dreamed that you could build an arc like that. It worked magnificently." The betrayed version of Sting, wrote Tom DeShane in an essay entitled Ancient Greek Storytelling in Modern Pop Culture, How Nitro Became Cable's Top Program, was a vigilante, a lone wolf, an outlaw, a dark and brooding character. He was one who had been hurt and had nothing left to lose, one who was determined to destroy the NWO, the virus that had turned his friends against him and destroyed the company that he loved for so many years. He was a societal misfit and a rebel, the type of Sting that audiences of the late 90s could identify with and live vicariously through, and a character that felt like a genuine threat to the New World Order. Throughout Sting's metamorphosis, various plot points involving WCW's new anti-hero were strikingly subtle in their emergence, occasionally nuanced in their execution, and, at some level, somewhat subliminal in their presentation. For example, consider the segment initiating the January 20th, 1997 edition of WCW Monday Nitro, a show broadcast in front of a particularly raucous Chicago crowd. Sting interrupted Randy Savage's apparent hijacking of the show to confront him in the ring, although not necessarily in a manner which fans could have reasonably predicted. "Sting circles Savage, leaving fans to wonder what will happen," describes MIT professor Sam Ford in an upcoming book of mine. "He pokes at him. Finally, Sting invites Savage to attack him with the bat. The action is drawn out as fans revel in the moment of wondering, that moment wrestling fans are always seeking." "Like any good serialized story," continues Ford, "the dramatic moment ends with a way to keep that feeling of mystery serialized. As Savage follows Sting out into the crowd, that moment of confusion and wonder, that sense of not knowing what will happen next, can carry on through the show, and leave fans to linger in wondering how this storyline will continue, while waiting for Savage and Sting to appear once again." As if to demonstrate a kind of show-but-don't-tell philosophy, Nitro viewers were often left asking more questions than they had answers for, and throughout 1997, that formula appeared to pay dividends for WCW as a company. Regardless of the follow-through accompanying a particular creative idea, WCW presented, throughout it all, Sting's character in remarkably consistent fashion. he was shown to be a courageous yet dangerous presence in standing up to the villainous NWO, and accordingly, Hogan appeared terrified of Sting whenever in his presence. These kind of subtleties only served to compound the negative impact resulting from the bizarre spectacle of Starrcade 97. Rather than make quick work of Hogan, for example, or hurry to deliver his signature Scorpion Deathlock maneuver, Sting simply locked up, in a manner not too dissimilar from a regular wrestling contest, as a means of starting his match with Hogan. For his part, Hogan, having consistently cowered from Sting all throughout 1997, wrestled during the match with almost a jarring sense of confidence. As the main event unfolded, the match appeared to develop in a strikingly illogical fashion, given that in kayfabe, fans could have predicted Sting squashing Hogan in short order, or at least attempting something to that effect. Conversely, the booking of the WrestleMania 40 main event was a decided masterpiece in comparison. Longtime WWE fans were quick to detect numerous callbacks to the storylines of years past, including, most notably, the brilliance of Seth Rollins' involvement in thwarting Roman Reigns. In scripting Rollins to act as a literal shield and distract the attention of Reigns, WWE followed through on an earlier line of dialogue between Rollins and Rhodes, while simultaneously furthering the narrative in an element central to Reigns' character that Rollins' 2014 betrayal of his former partner continues to be his undoing. Enveloping it all was Cody's well-branded quest to, quote, finish his story, or to accomplish something that his father, Dusty Rhodes, had never been able to do. For the first time ever, announced Michael Cole at the finish, a Rhodes can call himself WWE Champion. Therefore, in leveraging years of character development and backstory to support its WrestleMania 40 ending, WWE at once paid off years of dedicated fan support and retroactively made sense of elements from its prior decade of programming. Factor 2, the use of nostalgia. In an earlier edition of Beyond Nitro, we discussed the fact that often throughout wrestling history, external elements act as apparent force multipliers to enhance the impact of a particular segment, character, or show. For example, at WrestleMania 18, The Rock and Hollywood Hogan delivered a fairly pedestrian wrestling match, on the surface, but one that found itself greatly enhanced by the contextual factors at play. The star power emanating from each character, as well as the novelty factor underlying their matchup and an especially rabid crowd in Toronto, combined to make Rock Hogan an undoubted WrestleMania classic. To that end, a particularly potent force multiplier in wrestling tends to be nostalgia, a device that arguably, particularly in the case of WWE, promotions have relied upon to the point of diminishing returns. For instance, whether it was bringing back The Rock or Goldberg or featuring Triple H in numerous high-profile matches, WWE once found itself, arguably, in a holding pattern, whereby the stars of yesteryear, derided as, quote, part-timers in the eyes of some of the younger talent, were consistently called upon to save the latest WrestleMania or Royal Rumble pay-per-view. However, WrestleMania 40, on the other hand, demonstrated perhaps the perfect use of nostalgia. The inclusion of characters such as John Cena and The Undertaker only complemented the presence of the younger main event stars, as well as helping to underscore the importance of the match more generally. In other words, the nostalgic elements failed to detract from the action, and consequently, it only enhanced it, effectively making a marquee matchup even more important. Although even in 1997 there would have been plenty of scope for Starrcade to incorporate something, such as nostalgia, as a powerful force multiplier to enhance the in-ring action, such an effort simply failed to materialize. For all intents and purposes, Sting and Hogan simply performed a routine wrestling match, without particular adherence, reference, or deference to their specific storyline. From an outsider's perspective, the resultant action didn't especially make sense, and therefore, the impact of Sting's title win was predictably muted. Factor 3. Je ne sais quoi. The third factor propelling WrestleMania 40 to historic heights was a once-in-a-lifetime set of circumstances which provided the emotional backdrop for the entire event. Specifically, it was the first WrestleMania without either the involvement of, or an association with, Vince McMahon Jr., and as such, the atmosphere in Philadelphia was more than simply powerful. It was cathartic. Whether it was Samantha Irvin's choked-up call at the three count, the stirring post-match scene, or Michael Cole's pronouncement that, quote, pro wrestling is back, it is undoubtable that the events preceding McMahon's departure contributed to make WrestleMania 40 even more special than advertised. It was the apparent elephant in the room, so to speak, throughout the entire weekend. Therefore, in many respects, Rhodes' title win represented a, quote, clean break of sorts, signaling the end of the McMahon era. It provided an unprecedented emotional release, in and of itself, for fans who have derided both WWE's creative direction and its wider company ethos. This event, summarized one editorial on ageofthenerd.com, was not just about the matches, but also the moments that will be etched in the memories of fans for years to come. From the elaborate entrances to the emotional victories and defeats, WrestleMania 40 Night 2 delivered a blend of athleticism, drama, and storytelling that is the hallmark of WWE's biggest night. It was a night that celebrated the past, present, and future of professional wrestling, leaving fans eagerly anticipating what the next chapter will bring. In summary, and especially if the events of WrestleMania 40 are anything to go by, sports entertainment is perhaps now considered dead. If indeed that is the case, there's only one thing left to say. Long live professional wrestling. Alright, so that was my read of this month's article, comparing and contrasting the impact of WrestleMania 40 and Starrcade 97. As I mentioned in the intro, a number of people have made comments through social media and in other forums to the effect of, this is what we always dreamed Starrcade 97 could have been. You know, this huge emotional payoff to an amazing long-term storyline. And as I said in the article, what I didn't want to do this month was kind of relitigate or review a lot of factors that have already been discussed ad nauseum in the past. We all know the story by now as to why, you know, Starrcade did not come off as intended. But what I wanted to do was highlight some of the elements that may not have been immediately obvious, or at least some that came to mind for myself personally. And as I mentioned there, really there were three things that stood out. The first was just the incorporation of these amazing subtleties in the storytelling. Most notably, Seth Rollins, as I mentioned in the piece there, acting as a literal shield. And, you know, that amazing callback to a moment that happened 10 years previous really just showed an attention to detail that cemented, I think, that ending of WrestleMania Night 2 as a historic moment in the history of professional wrestling. So that was the first thing that stood out to me. The second thing, as I touched on there, was the use of nostalgia as what I look at as a force multiplier. In other words, some kind of factor that takes what's happening in the ring and makes it even bigger and even broader and more impactful. And I think every classic moment or segment or match in wrestling, you know, at least from my standpoint, tends to benefit from that. And the example I gave in the piece was the Hogan Rock match at WrestleMania 18. You know, if you were to imagine that match taking place in front of an empty arena, I don't think it would be regarded as anywhere near the classic that it is. You know, on paper, they didn't necessarily do that much, but because of all of the contextual factors or circumstances at play, that really propelled that match to be something that you could show to a non-wrestling fan. And I think by virtue of the crowd involvement alone, they would be very interested in it. And I would put the WrestleMania 40 Night 2 ending into that box as well. You know, you could show someone, if you gave them maybe a little bit of an indication as to what was going on between Cody Rhodes and Roman Reigns, you could show them that tape, as it were, and I think they would be very much drawn in by the emotion of it all. And the final factor, what I'm kind of touching on there, is, you know, sometimes it takes just a little special something that cannot necessarily be planned or predicted or accounted for in order for, you know, an event in wrestling to really resonate with people. And I think it's undoubtedly the fact to me that when you look at especially the way that event ended, It was very much a cathartic moment, I think, for all of the participants involved and the fans as well. The fact that there had been a sense for a long period of time that WWE was just going to go through this sort of metronomic fall off in terms of its creative quality. I think fans had kind of got accustomed to not buying in too much to the creative direction for fear that storylines would not get resolved or the storylines would happen in the first place because of maybe personal animus or issues or agendas or desire to present talent in ways that aren't necessarily good for business. So I think people would, there was a period there where a lot of fans would consider the WWE product not only unwatchable, but also destined to sort of stay in that same realm for a long period of time. And then, of course, much of the fan base having a knowledge of some of the things that went on in the company that they weren't, to say the least, comfortable with. So the fact that this event signaled sort of this transition, if you like, from sports entertainment to professional wrestling, and the fact that fans were very much aware and the performers themselves that this was the first event without the involvement of or at least the association with Vince McMahon, I think really made WrestleMania 40 even more special than it was already going to be, given the fact that this was the 40th, 40th WrestleMania. So those are some of my thoughts, and I kind of contrasted that with the presentation of Starrcade 97. Would love to hear what you guys think about this column or any of the other pieces that we've reviewed so far here on Beyond Nitro. As we talked about last month, and I was very happy to have the involvement of TJ Stevens in helping to make last month's episode possible. But as we talked about, we're very much a fan of having variety on this show. So I do anticipate as time goes on, we'll try to give you a different look and a different feel every time we come on the airwaves. And I think that's what will make Beyond Nitro stand out. But for the time being, I do have a little bit of a bonus for you. So to conclude this month's edition of Beyond Nitro, I'm going to present to you an exclusive excerpt from a book called Sitting Ringside Volume 1. It's a new book that just came out, written by David Penzer, formerly the ring announcer for WCW and TNA, and also myself. I was the co-author on this project. It's available on Amazon and also at guyevansbooks.com. But I wanted to end things by giving you a little bit of a taste of what's included in this book. One of the favorite things that I've ever written, in fact, this new autobiography with David Penzer. You may have seen some chatter about it on social media. The book comes with, I think, over 200 pages of amazing bonus materials, including the last Nitro script and all of these other things that have never been seen before, that both David and myself had access to. So I think if you've really enjoyed my writing in the past, and if just in general you're looking for a great wrestling read, I can't recommend the book enough. And I know David is extremely excited about it as well. So the name of the book, Sitting Ringside Volume 1, and once again, this is an excerpt from one of the chapters of the book. It's Chapter 9. It's called Back to the Future. So I'm going to leave you with that to conclude this week. So here we go. Chapter 9 of Sitting Ringside Volume 1, Back to the Future. Starrcade 96 is when I first noticed we were really on fire. A red-hot Nashville crowd ate up the December 29th pay-per-view, which featured on the undercard an array of incredible matches. Ultimo Dragon vs. Dean Malenko, Jushin Liger vs. Rey Mysterio Jr., and Jeff Jarrett vs. Chris Benoit, just to name a few. In the main event, Rowdy Roddy Piper beat Hollywood Hogan in a non-title match, a curious stipulation given its initial build-up on television. Nonetheless, after Piper and Hogan's historic rivalry in the 80s, it was fun to see them feud again, albeit this time with the roles reversed. With those guys on top, Starrcade 96 became the most purchased WCW pay-per-view, to that point, in company history. Roddy was always one of my favorites. I remember him doing commentary in Georgia Championship Wrestling where he was extremely charismatic, with a habit of saying stuff that nobody else was at the time. Everything from the lines that Roddy came up with to the critiques he gave the wrestlers were just so different. Like many fans, I then remember his babyface turn in Georgia, after he defended Gordon Soley from Don Morocco, and then his introduction to the WWF in 1984. I was a huge mark for Piper's Pit, and I give Roddy credit for getting me hooked on the WWF, just like Dusty did with Championship Wrestling from Florida. Back then, I honestly never could have imagined that someday I'd get to know the real guy, Roderick Toombs. I think he was the most complicated guy that I ever met in the wrestling business, and that's saying a lot. On a personal level, Roddy was hard to get to know, mostly because of some of the things that happened in his early life. Without going into too many details, because that's not really my place, I know that Roddy had a horrible childhood. I personally had many conversations with him about it, but in all of those conversations, he never talked about anything that happened before turning 15, the year in which he entered the wrestling business. As a matter of fact, I never heard him talk about those years with anybody, although he did, to the best of my knowledge, eventually confide in a few people. It's amazing, quite frankly, that Roddy didn't decide to jump off a building, given everything that he experienced. Equally amazing is the fact that he became ultra successful, one of the best talkers in the history of the business, a great worker, and a transcendent wrestler as well. He starred in movies, he had a wife and four children, he did all that, despite battling a lot of demons in the process. My interpretation is that Roddy kind of blacked out the first 15 years of his life, a task much easier said than done. You can black stuff out, in my opinion, but you can't ever forget it. He was a very, very complex person, and as a result, some people perceived him as distant. In reality, he was one of the kindest people you could ever meet. Whenever he saw you, he'd give you a hug, bring you in close, and put his arm around you. Hey, how are you doing? How's the family? He was the warmest person in those situations. Right now, I can see it in my mind's eye, the way he stood up to greet people and shake their hand. When he met a fan, he would put both of his hands around their one hand, and he'd pat them on the back while listening intently. Roddy, they'd say, you're my hero. I'll never forget the angle with Jimmy Snuka. Thank you so much, Roddy would respond. If you don't mind me asking, what did you like about it? Believe it or not, Piper actually showed a very sweet personality in those moments. When it came to business, on the other hand, he didn't fuck around. There was an angle on Nitro, it aired on November 18th, 1996 to be exact, where about 10 police officers tried to hold Roddy back from getting to the NWO. Eric Bischoff had just been revealed in storyline as being aligned with the group. If you go back and look at that footage, you'll see that the cops in the ring couldn't hold Piper back. Well, that's Roddy. Whether he was scripted to act like that or not, he would have done it anyway. Roddy legitimately viewed everything that happened as if it were a shoot. Part of that was based on his self-perception. He saw himself as a tough guy, a street fighter, and that's what he wanted his reputation to be. Therefore, if you put him in a situation where he was being held back by 10 cops, he was going to fight like mad to get through them. Knowing him, I know that's exactly what he would have done in the same real-life situation. I'll say it again. In Roddy's mind, pro wrestling was a shoot. Okay, he wasn't really hurting anybody, although from what I heard he was stiff as fuck, but there was a reason why he used the word fights instead of matches in his promos. From his perspective, he would think, okay, the finish is predetermined, but everything else is a fucking shoot. He lived his entire life that way. It might have been almost a defense mechanism for him. I think Roddy believed, as a result of his background, fame, and fortune, that people would try and take advantage of him. He was wary about being exploited, and maybe, although this is speculation on my part, that's partly why he treated things the way he did. Roddy was a conundrum in many ways. He was so unbelievably talented and confident, but at the same time, he was painfully insecure. Having learned a little bit about psychology, it seemed like Roddy felt he could never achieve enough, like he could never be enough. You could say that everybody has insecurities, and mine arose during my time in WCW because I was so afraid of losing my dream, but Roddy's were especially fundamental. For him, it all went back to those early years. And with that, we're going to wrap up the show for this month. I hope you enjoyed my look at WrestleMania 40, comparing and contrasting it to Starrcade 97, and also giving you guys a taste there of what I think is a fantastic read, Sitting Ringside Volume 1, David Penza and myself, our new collaboration. That book is out now on Amazon and also at GuyEvansBooks.com. But that is it for this month. So I thank you all very much for listening, and I'll see you next time as we travel beyond Nitron.